Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. To see PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
Hi, Eva. It's good to see you.
Hi, it's good to see you too.
You visited a part of New Zealand where a majority of the country's braided rivers run. Just describe what that looks like in natural form.
Yeah, so they're really beautiful and strange. When you fly over them, they appear, as their namesake suggests, braided. They're these kind of long, meandering, woven rivers that sort of split and come together and then veer off into all of these different channels and paths. And they start up in the alpine ridges on the east coast and then sort of make their way across the vast Canterbury Plains, which are really flat, out to the east coast. They're these really beautiful sort of milky turquoise colour. And then when you kind of get down to ground level, they're these kind of long, flat, gravelly beds in front of you. And then they'll be cut through with all of these tiny channels and in some cases, large, deep flowing channels. The banks aren't really particularly noticeable. It's all kind of low level. And then you'll have little islands that might have some growth on them, but it's very sort of rocky and atmospheric.
And they're quite rare, is that right? You don't find these sorts of rivers in many places in the world.
Yeah, that's right. So they're really globally rare. They're just found in a few places in North America, in Canada, some in Europe, in the Himalayas. And New Zealand has about 150 braided rivers, and 60% of those are concentrated in Canterbury. So we have this really high density of them with people living quite closely alongside them. You know, our rivers here, they're considered particularly, I guess, good examples internationally. And in the upper reaches near the Alpines, they're fairly unscathed up there. So they're quite good places for people to go and study and learn about them.
So they're called braided because of what you describe, how they twist and turn. What makes them change course and move?
So unlike single channel rivers, they have multiple channels. And broadly what happens is that because they start in the alpine ranges, they come with a huge amount of gravel and sediment. And this water flow will come down, deposit that sediment everywhere in its path and create new and different channels as it moves. And when you get, I guess, a big kind of dumping of rain or there's a glacial shift, that can cause water to flow more sort of rapidly and intensely down these braids and bring with it more sediment, more debris. And they can change paths again. They might retreat from old paths. They might go back to new ground. So they're just always in this process of constant motion.
So when they move, they leave behind all of this rich soil, the sediment that you've described. And communities and farmers, they move in to then capitalize on that. Is that right? And set up on the riverbank.
Yeah, so that's right. And I mean, there are a few ways that narrowing of the rivers occurs, and that is the primary one. It's what's known as agricultural encroachment. When the river moves away from an area, a landowner, usually a farmer, might come in and take over that really beautiful fertile ground and begin farming it. And then if the river tries to move back again over that land, the landowner might request the local authorities to come in and put a stop bank up to prevent that happening. And then that can happen on the other side of the river. So what you have is this sort of narrowing on both sides of the river. It's a really big problem in Canterbury, particularly because that is where intensive dairy farming is really prosperous. So when that land comes up, people jump on it. I looked back at some of the maps and imagery in the decades gone past, and you can see how dramatic that narrowing is in some places. You know, there's in some regions, entire branches of a river have been completely taken over by a patchwork of farms, and then others that are very narrow now.
I was fascinated to read that it was described, especially in the 1920s, as a flood menace, which basically begs the question that when the river moves again, it's going to flood the communities that have set up there. So what is happening to the rivers so that people don't get their land flooded?
Yeah, so that was fascinating, actually, kind of talking to people about the attitudes that have shaped the way braided rivers are treated here. And, you know, when the first settlers came in and started building Christchurch, they largely ignored that braided river. I think they probably didn't have much of a reference point for it. They likely assumed that it was similar to kind of a single channel river, that it was predictable, that it was constant. Then there were these big floods that happened. I think it was 1868. There was what was dubbed the Great Storm, and that was a huge localized downpour which caused the Waimakariri River, which is now running through parts of modern day Christchurch, and the nearby Ashley River to flood, and it created this big sort of inland sea. And then another flood happened and another. And so I think by the 1920s, the local authorities in Christchurch were catching on that these rivers weren't what they were used to.
They're supposed to change and flood and move around. That's how they operate naturally.
That's right. But their response to that was describing the Waimakariri as a flood menace. And it's what is kind of a wonderful turn of phrase, but is very revealing of the colonial attitude of that time, which was that the river showed, and I quote, a deficiency of nature which must be made good by the art of man. So that precipitated this hemming in of the river, trying to kind of bring it into submission. And so they put in stop banks. They started planting exotic trees to kind of keep the banks stable. And they also had to start constantly extracting gravel. And what that did was it kind of allowed a city and industry to sort of be built around its edges. But it also essentially condemned future generations to this Sisyphean fate of having to endlessly maintain this river. So they have to constantly now extract gravel to stop the riverbed rising and then breaching the stop banks. They have to maintain the stop banks. They have to keep planting exotic trees and also then stop the exotic trees from trying to take off, because that's another whole separate issue that's come from this. And if they don't do this, if they don't keep the river tamed, that's going to result in the flooding of tens of thousands of homes, infrastructure, the nearby airport. It's a huge, constant process.
So they've created a real rod for their backs, and it sounds like real damage to the ecosystem. And we are going to talk about that. But I'm very curious, because you talked about the effect of colonization. But traditional owners, Maori tribes, have coexisted with the rivers for hundreds of years. So how have they managed to do that?
I think for Maori, they take a really holistic view towards the environment and to rivers and how they're cared for. There's this Maori whakatauki or proverb from a tribe in the North Island, which is, ko o te awa, ko te awa, ko o. I am the river and the river is me. And that, so they're really intrinsic to Māori identity, the significant sort of reference points for genealogy, for connection to place. They're really important for the practice of mahinga kai, which is sort of traditional food gathering. They were used as transport routes, for bathing, for hunting grounds. They're kind of this canvas by which tribes can pass on generational knowledge. Now there's this real fear that knowledge will be curtailed because the rivers are changing and facing ecosystem collapse.
And they've also spoken to you about the real damage in the rivers and the pollutions. I was really shocked to read about the massive drop in salmon stocks, for one, and some of the pollution that the Maori tribes have discovered as they try to continue their traditional food gathering methods.
Yeah, that's right. So when I spoke to Kaitahu, which is the largest South Island iwi, they said that many of their members stopped fishing in their rivers in recent years after hauling up cow feces in their nets. And there's a huge amount of anguish associated with the loss of fish and the pollution that they're witnessing. When I spent time with some of the people who fish on the river, local fishers, anglers, people that have been fishing for the last sort of 40 years down there, they talked about how the Rakaia River, which is one of the large rivers that I visited, was abundant with fish. And even if you weren't catching them, you were seeing them. And now they go down to the river and they don't even see a fish. They've stopped fishing altogether.
Fish stocks have really plummeted.
They've really plummeted, yeah. So, I mean, there was a fish and game report survey that was done on the Rakaia River salmon last year, and that showed that there were 608 salmon in the river, which compared to 1996, there were 20,000. So
huge difference. 20,000 to just hundreds is extraordinary.
It's huge. And this year, I mean, there's this annual salmon fishing competition that's been going in that area for 40 years. And this year they went ahead and said there was to be no fishing allowed.
In the competition.
In the competition. And I mean, this is coming from a community where they have a giant salmon statue sitting in their town. Like, it's iconic there. The person that ran that competition quipped that it would be likely to become a monument to the past.
It's really emblematic to the damage that has been done to that ecosystem. Are there tensions between Maori traditional owners and the government over what has happened to the river? I understand there's some legal action taking place.
Yeah, there is. So in 2017, Kaitahu took a landmark case against the Crown, which is seeking to have their rangatiratanga, which is kind of governing authority and sort of self-determination, recognised over South Island's waterways. And it's the first time that the courts have heard a claim of legal recognition for rangatiratanga over fresh water. And the reason they've done this is that they argue there have been repeated failures over successive governments to protect the country's waterways, and that with the changing governments, policies of the long view never kind of get legs, and that needs to change. And they've witnessed the degradation of those waters, of their fishing grounds.
So this is a landmark case now.
It is. And there's still a decision to come. We don't know what that decision is going to look like yet. But essentially what they're asking for is to establish a new co-managed freshwater regime with the Crown that protects the rivers and accommodates iwi's interests.
What is the Crown case?
I mean, the Crown case is broadly that Kaitahu's claims are sort of too vague, and that the proposed declarations cut across existing laws and Parliament's sovereignty. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that.
We'll be right back.